Thank you for joining me on Breaking Free from Narcissistic Abuse. I'm your host, Dr. Carrie Kerr McAvoy, and this is going to be a lively podcast. We're going to be talking about issues like, can narcissists change? And if we got into a relationship in which there is deception, did we actually give consent? Don't forget to subscribe so you don't miss future episodes. Leave a review, let us know what you think. And also, since we're listener-supported, consider giving a contribution so that you can ensure the podcast continues. So today I want to talk about something that has become a hot topic in this community, in the Narc Talk community on TikTok, and that is whether or not narcissists can change. In fact, I've seen several videos that have taken a very strong stance to the point of blocking creators who are self-aware narcissists. Others have called out anybody who's supporting a narcissist, a self-aware narcissist creator. And even I got a comment yesterday of someone saying to me, now that I know that you are supportive of these individuals, I'm not sure I can follow you anymore. So let's talk about why this is such a touchy topic. What has gone into it on our side that has made us feel such strong feelings? And then let's even talk about whether or not narcissists can change. What does even change mean? Why does a mental health community encourage partners and family members of narcissists to let go of the wish for change? I want to really kind of look at all these types of issues because it triggers us. And I think it's really important to understand why this topic is so uncomfortable, why it's so triggering. I know some of my own reactions about why it triggers me. And yes, honestly, it does trigger me. When I meet somebody like Ben of Raw Motivation or Lee of Mental Healness, it affects me. I'm thrilled that they're working on their shit and getting it together. But it also makes me wonder, why was my narcissist not more supportive and do that kind of work in order to preserve the relationship with me? So now my situation, for those of you who have read my book, Love You More, The Harrowing Tale of Lies, Sex, Addiction, and Double Cross, know there was a whole nother thing going on with mine. So mine really wasn't about wanting a relationship with me. Mine was more about conning me. But that's a rarity. That's not the common situation. So I would love to hear, can we structure the questions today around your issues with, is change possible? Why are you being discouraged from hoping for change? What does change look like? If you have questions around those issues, or is it reasonable to expect this kind of change in the relationship you're currently in? I would love to have us structure our questions around that. So if you don't mind putting them in the Q&A, then I will address them in that. I'm Dr. Carrie Kerr McAvoy. I am a licensed psychologist with over 20 years of clinical experience both in the psychiatric hospital as well as in private practice. This is a safe space for us to talk about very tough topics for mental health issues. It's not the same. It's not to be used as a substitution for counseling. If you feel you are not doing well and you need to get help, please seek help. Do not use this as a substitute for that or a surrogate for that. Let's talk about narcissism and whether or not narcissists can change. And there was one question that came through. One of the questions that came in about narcissists and narcissists changing is, how do you know if you should leave if they've promised to change? I'm torn. That is a very good question, a very common question. I actually spent a long time on that issue myself when I was in a relationship. And please, for those of you who are just joining, please put your questions in the Q&A and I will make sure to address them one by one. So how do we know if a narcissist is changing? That's a tough one because one of the things that happens is they are very good at telling us what we want to hear. That's even how love bombing is. A lot of like over the top demonstration of, I'm so into you, you're the most amazing person in the world. And yet when they start to drop the mask, then their behavior no longer follows up with their words. And so one of the things that we have to learn to do is watch for what they do, don't watch for what they're saying. That's actually the truth. Even as a therapist in the office, people would come in and say, I really want this to happen. And then we would talk about what's getting in their way. And then they would go out and they would do nothing different. And then they would come in and say it again. The lack of effort showed a lack of investment in change. And so that's what I would look for in your partner. If you are actually wanting to know whether or not there is really a desire to change, you're going to see that in their change behavior. So for example, if you have asked them to stay in touch with you, not disappear, drop off the grid for long periods of time, and then they do, and you talk to them about it and they get cross, I would see that as not authentic desire to be better. I would see that as just lip service. So you need to see consistent change over a long period of time. That's how you're going to know. So what I would recommend, this is just a thought, you might want to set a date, a private date with yourself, and set up a list of maybe like six things you want to see different. Tell them two, don't tell them all six, keep the other four back. And then watch what happens. By the date, when that date arrives, pull your list out and remind yourself of it. If they've changed on the majority of those things, especially the ones that you never asked for, then I don't see that as authentic desire for change. I see that really as a request for things not to change for them. That's what often happens, is they like the relationship. It's comfortable for them. They don't really want to lose that. They don't want to have to start over. So they say enough to keep in the good graces with you, but they're not actually doing the heavy lifting of making a change. I hope that helps. Boy, it was a tough one for me when I was in that position, and I really feel for your situation. It's hard. I've never known a narcissist to change, have you? Yeah, actually I have. I'm a clinician, so I've treated narcissists in the office. I've actually had some people come by, and specifically who are narcissists who wanted things to be better, knew something was wrong, and then did a lot of hard work. They came in every week. They talked about very, very tough topics. They dealt with their shame. They learned to be vulnerable, and they made changes in their lives. Were they a profoundly different person? Well, let's ask you the question. How much change do you think you're capable of as a person? I doubt that you would completely, you know, if you're an extrovert, that you'd suddenly become an introvert. Or if you're an introvert, that you'd suddenly become extremely extroverted. But I do think we can make modifications. Maybe that's a better word. We can make modifications. So to say that change isn't possible is really to say that you can't change either, that we are all fixed. Now, one of the things that's kind of important to know about change is built on habits. So when you consistently make a different decision over and over and over, eventually even your feelings change and how you perceive it, and the brain structure changes. You begin to build new pathways, synaptic pathways, and the old pathways start to fade away and disintegrate from lack of use. So it is possible, but it takes habitual practice. And there's where most of us don't do well, is that we aren't able to stick with the habitual change over a long period of time. But I do believe change is possible. It's the degree of change. Now, if you're asking someone to say, if you have a person who's highly callous, has a hard time even putting themselves in your position of having that kind of empathy, are you going to have someone who down the road is super sympathetic and weeps over Hallmark cards with you? I doubt it. Probably not. But can you have someone that learns to say, when you say something sensitive, a follow-up question? Yeah, I think that is possible. But here's the thing. I'm going to go ahead and jump into this because this is kind of tied together. The reason we tell partners and family members not to look for change in a narcissist is because that's why we stay. We stay for a person's potential, not because of what's happening. And then we hold on hope that the potential will come, and we put ourselves in often in risky, if not even dangerous, situations. That's why we tell partners not, that you need to base your decision based upon a person's behavior. And if you're not seeing a consistent change of behavior, then you need to begin to really think about what you're going to do to protect yourself better. Because one of the things that happens is that we tend to look outside of ourselves for protection. We tend to externalize our safety. For example, I put security on my house. I make sure the doors are locked. But what am I doing when it comes to relationship issues? What am I doing in the interior of myself to keep myself safe? when I look to somebody around me to ask the right questions, to show up, to be loyal, to be available, that puts me, I'm not in control. That puts me at risk. I'm not able to control those things. But I can control the degree of what I expect from somebody or how much I'm around somebody. Those are the things that I can control. That's why clinicians tell patients to not wait for change, not to sit and bank your protection, your life, your well-being on the ability of someone else to do or not do something for you. It's too risky. You're always maintaining better control when you do that for yourself. I agree with you, Minna. It is way difficult for people to change at a core level. It takes enormous desire. And most of us, frankly, just don't have that kind of desire. We're kind of, I hate to say it, but we're kind of lazy in that way. So Adam wants to know, what happens when you cheat on a narcissist? That's a fascinating question, actually. Have you guys heard of what's called a narcissistic wound? So we're all prone to it, by the way, because by the way, we're all on the spectrum. You're somewhere between slightly immature to very pathologically immature. We're all somewhere on this, none of us get away from this dilemma. So as a result, when someone pricks our pride, makes us feel uncomfortable or embarrassed, we have a reaction. Have you ever noticed when someone says something, you know, maybe whatever it is, you know, maybe it's like it slights you in a classroom about a grade, or maybe it's somebody cuts you off on the road, or maybe a colleague doesn't give you the right kind of credit. You feel like this, you know, this intensity, you know, even you want to be a bit explosive. That's called a narcissistic wound. Narcissists are very sensitive to these, and it may even be in a way that you don't anticipate because it might not be something that would bother you. So cheating is a huge betrayal of any relationship. It's a breach of the intimacy. It's a destruction of trust and loyalty. It also suggests there's something flawed about the partner, that they failed to show up in some way that's essential for you, that you needed. Now, granted, maybe it is that this person is there in most ways, but you felt a need for something with someone else outside of the relationship for whatever reason, and it will be experienced by the partner being cheated on as if there's something wrong with them. So I would expect intense rage. That's what I would expect. And if this person has any borderline qualities, I'd be very careful, because that person may then be at risk to self-harm, but also risk to become impulsive. So you may want to pull in counsel, outside counsel, to help you if you feel this is important to break this news to them. I would really urge you to kind of build in safety around yourself. Now, I know I'm going to say something super controversial. If this was a one-time mistake and you never plan to do it again, I really then question your need to say anything, because your need to say something is really for you to offload your guilt. If it is a habitual thing where it may happen again and that's a problem for you, then definitely your partner needs to be informed, because otherwise they don't really have consent about the kind of relationship they have with you. And if you don't have full consent, then it's really actually a coercive relationship. And that's something completely different. I think we need to all wake up around that, is that when we're not completely honest in a relationship, then that person cannot honestly choose us, then we don't have their consent. And you know what that means. So I would really, if that's a problem, then you need to come clean. But if it was a slip and you now feel so much remorse and regret and you'll never slip again, I think maybe best to keep it to yourself. I know not everybody will agree with me on that, but those are just some of my opinions. Pamela's husband doesn't have emotional attachment to people. That's really interesting. It's kind of, it makes me wonder. I suspect they probably might have a trauma past or be a highly defended person. So my question for you, Pamela, is how is it impacting you? My suspicion is that you're probably very lonely. And if you have children with this person, that you're probably concerned about how much of a parent this person's being to your kids. Can you say more about what's going on and how that's concerning you? Because I'd be kind of curious to hear more about that. Do I hurt a narcissist if we leave them? Yeah, usually what happens in a narcissistic relationship is there's three phases. The first is idealization or love bombing. And the second part is disillusionment. So what happens is a narcissist, just like you, I just put up a video about that. Both of us, both people, come into a relationship with hopes and wishes and dreams. We have sort of fantasized image of what we really want out of a relationship. And when we get into that, we discover that we've married a real person. They're not actually what we imagined. We kind of, and the more far off from our dream and wishes that real actual person is, then the more likely we're to feel very disillusioned. And that's the problem with narcissists and other toxic people who have emotional immaturity, is they have a lot of idealization. They have this sort of almost kind of like a fairy tale Disney feeling wish for a relationship that it's going to solve all their unmet needs and it's going to be this incredible experience. Yeah, we all have some of that to some degree, but theirs is more extreme. And then when they get into a relationship with somebody and they realize, wow, I've married a real person who puts on their pants one time, you know, one leg at a time, there's this massive kind of shock. And then grief and then rage. And you guys have all seen that. If you've lived with somebody like that, you've seen that response. And then they begin to move to discard you. But sometimes there's enough in the relationship that provides enough, you know, comfort, maybe enough resources or whatever that person's looking for, that they don't really want to disrupt the family. They don't want to really disrupt the situation. So as a result, they stay. Well, as the other person realizes, they're not easy to live with. This person's toxic. They're abusive. I can't stick around. And then I get ready to leave. In the same way that cheating is a narcissistic wound, discarding a narcissist is also a narcissistic wound. So again, the same advice I have for the person who asked, what if I cheated on him? I would be warned in the same way. You know, this person, that your partner may be at risk to be enraged, to get even, hold grudges. Those are kind of things that, you know, again, think about what a emotional 3-year-old would do, because that's the emotional level that most narcissists are operating on. How would they handle disappointment? Not well. I would expect your person in your life not to respond well. Someone asked me to comment again about honesty in marriage and honesty in relationships, so I'm going to jump back to the point. One of the things, and I'll tell you why. Let me give you the backstory of why. And for those of you who may have read my book, Love You More, The Harrowing Tales of Lies, Sex Addiction, and Double Cross, you know what happened in my marriage. And this is my story of what happened. And it happened in 2017 to 2019. I met and married a narcissistic sociopath who had ulterior motives, and I got into the, here I'm a psychologist, and I got into this devastating relationship. I was grieving. I had just lost my husband of 31 years to cancer. I wanted the life that I had lost back, and I jumped too fast into the next relationship. Well, I just learned, I thought, you know, when writing the book, I went through a lot of information. I did interviews. So I tried to get even more than I knew at the time of the marriage. I tried to get back, you know, find out more. And I thought I had a pretty good handle on it. There was a period of time, though, that I suspected he was cheating and I wasn't for sure. By the way, he's a serial cheater. I suspected he was cheating, but I wasn't really for sure he was cheating. And I gave a person in the building where we were living a copy of the book as a gift. He'd wanted it and had asked for it. And he texted me afterwards and said, you reminded me of something. While you were living in this building, this was the period of time I suspected he was cheating, but I couldn't find proof. He said, I ended up being seated at a table beside him at a restaurant. He was with another woman. So now I know he was cheating in that period of time. I suspected he was, but now I know that he was. He was cheating the entire time of the relationship. He was cheating from the moment I met him. He never was not cheating. So here's where I was going with this point. If I had met a person who said to me, I want an open marriage. I want you to be monogamous, but I'm not going to be. And I expect exclusivity with you to give that to me. But please know that I'm going to be in all levels, not with that with you at all. Do you think I would have said yes? Absolutely not. Absolutely not. I would have been disgusted and disinterested as a result of that. So he entered the relationship under false pretenses. I said yes to something that never existed. I feel raped. And I don't use that word lightly. And I actually have been raped in real life. I was as a 4-year-old in my home by a family member. I know what that feels like, that devastation. This feels the same. When people don't give our consent to what they want from us, and they are not upfront with us, then we have gotten into the relationship. We have given our yes to something that's not true. That's coercive. That's coercive, guys. Anybody who at any level maintains a relationship for false pretenses, even if it's just to have sex when you think the other person wants a relationship, it's coercive. We need to stop. We need to become more frank, more authentic. We need to have radical honesty. If you don't like someone and you just want to sleep with them, then say that. We need to be upfront about all that. And thank you so much for you guys' support. I'm really okay. I mean, I've had a long time to deal with all of this, and that's writing the book was super, super helpful for me. Very, very healing about that relationship. Yeah, except for a moment, it sent me down a rabbit hole. I found like, what else don't I know? What day was that? And I, nope. It's not going to solve the bigger problems. I already know the big problems. The big problem is he's not honest. He's never been honest, and he didn't marry me for love. I know that. Why do I need to know more? So that's what happens to all of us. All of us end up feeling like if we had more proof, we'd be able to make a better decision. The problem is there isn't enough proof for you to make. I did make an audiobook. There isn't enough proof for you to make a good decision. You have to make it based on yourself, on what your worth, your value, your respect. You have to make it on that, not on whether or not it's. That's where I got stuck in. I was raised in a very religious home, very conservative home. I felt like I was being a good wife. I didn't want to like have a failure. I had stayed for 31 years with my first husband, and it wasn't always easy, and I didn't want to be, you know, we do it for these reasons, but I failed to ask myself the most important question is, did I feel safe? Did I feel loved? Was this person showing loyalty? No, he never did. Somebody asked earlier, why did I stay? I stayed for those reasons. I stayed that because I met somebody who presented a completely different picture. And then when the mask dropped, I was married. And he knew I had integrity. He knew I was a person that kept my word. I saw my late husband through to his death. I stood by his side, slept in the room in hospice for over 10 days while my late husband was dying. That's the kind of person I am. My ex knew that. He knew that. He counted on that. He used the best parts of me against me. That's what toxic people do, is they take what's wonderful and beautiful. In fact, even asking somebody that question suggests that we should just bail when things get hard. No, we don't bail. The hard part for all of us is, when do you leave? The line gets fuzzier the closer you get to it. You say from far away, well, if they cheat, I'll leave. But then when you're in the situation, you say, well, but it makes sense, and there's so much going on, and we had a lot of complexity, and can we maybe work on it? I mean, when you get close to these lines, when you start stand far away, it's easy to see the boundaries, but when you get close to the lines, it's very hard to see them. There are lots of mitigating effects lots of confounding variables that really mess it up and make it very hard to determine these decisions. So it isn't just simply just leave. There's lots of some of you have kids. Some of you have issues with jobs. Some of you may not know where you're going to go. Some of you have a community that expects something out of you. And then what happens with that? I mean, there's a whole bunch of things that kind of come in and make this highly complex. And for me, for those of you who haven't read my story, he was a partner in my company. And if I divorced him, he took half of all my assets that I invested. I can't just make him leave. I would lose half of everything I had. So it was very complex, and I had to do it in a very smart way. And that's why all of you have to, I know each of your situation is your situation, and it's going to look uniquely you, and you're going to have to do it in the way that you do it, that takes care of you. And anyone from the outside is really not going to know all the nuances. They're really not going to don't know those nuances. And yes, I am very glad I'm out, very glad I'm safe. I'm really glad that I was able to write about it and share it with you guys so that you know how complex it is. You know what love bombing looks like, what coercive control looks like, and all of that stuff. Yeah, it's very. So let me get back to the questions. How do I know if I'm a narcissist? Chances are, if you're asking me, you probably aren't. You probably aren't. Why? Because narcissists really struggle with self-reflection. They don't tend to wonder that. Now, my ex did wonder a bit. He said, I think that I am. And then he'd laugh. He'd think it was funny. I also have a family member who's a narcissist. They're totally not aware. Not at all. So most narcissists that I've met, even the ones in the office who'd come in for counseling, they rarely came out and asked me, and they didn't usually would even consider that. That usually isn't something they ask themselves. So the fact that you're asking me, but there's 9 criteria and you need to qualify on 5 of them. And I can't list off 9, but I can list a bunch of them. So they include, do you feel entitled to special privilege? Are you arrogant? Are you manipulative of other people? Do you struggle with envy and rage? What else? Do you struggle to have empathy? There I've listed, I think, at least 5 of them. I know that there are 4 more that I'm not listing off the top of my head, but they're very easy to find. If you go onto the web and look at DSM-5, 9 criteria for narcissism, you'll be easily to find them. But here's the question I have for you. Why are you asking? Because really there's a motivation behind your question, and it would be kind of interesting to hear what it is that you're concerned about that's making you wonder about that. There is another question that came in that's kind of in line with this, so I'm going to go ahead and add it, even though it really wasn't on a list, but it's why do empaths usually end up with narcissists? That's an easy one. By the way, they're thinking about calling the Cluster B group antagonistic personality types. They probably won't actually make that change, but right now they're called Cluster B. I don't really know why. I think it's because Cluster A, and then they're in the next group called Cluster B. It's probably that simple. All of the Cluster B, actually, the opposite of them is agreeableness, and then they're antagonistic. So that's the opposing. So just like introverts are opposite to extroverts, agreeableness, the opposite of agreeableness, is antagonistic. And Cluster B personality disorders are antagonistic. If you're an antagonistic person, what kind of person are you going to pick? You want someone who's not you, right? Someone who's opposite with you, who's going to put up with the things that you aren't. You know, somebody who's going to go along and be supportive and be loyal. They actually did a study on this, by the way. It's Sandra Brown out of Purdue University looked at 600 pathological love relationships. She found that it was not a history of trauma or insecurity or codependency that most correlated with picking a narcissistic abusive relationship. It was agreeableness and conscientiousness. Why? The very things that make you an ideal job candidate are also the things that make you an ideal partner to an antagonistic personality style. Because you are long-suffering, that you are very agreeable, you believe in the goodness of human nature, you also are very empathic. Isn't that interesting? Those are the things that have been correlated with antagonistic personality styles. Oh, I've been reading some of the comments come in, and I have not followed all of what's going on with this particular situation, but it sounds like you guys are really helping with I'm Just Slaying, and I am so sorry. It sounds like a really, really tough situation. I'm sorry that happens to a lot of us. We end up getting into these nearly impossible situations where there is no clear solution. You ever guys hear of the Lady and the Lion? There's a fairy tale. I don't think it was real, but there's a fairy tale that where there is a king looking for his daughter they were looking for a mate for his daughter. And so they bring in suitors and they'd have to select the door, and behind one would be a tiger and behind the other would be his daughter, right? The person would choose, and they would choose one would be a fantastic outcome and the other would be a very bad outcome. The problem with being in a pathological relationship with a narcissist or other toxic people is that there is no good solution. There is no lady behind the door. There's a lion behind every door. You lose whatever you do, you lose. You're going to lose very large whatever you do, which makes it even harder to do anything at all. That's why a lot of us stay as long as we do. It's not just because it's comfortable and familiar to us. It's because the toxicity of whatever choice we make is so awful that we feel stuck. We don't feel like we can make any decision. Any decision feels worse than the one what we're in. So I just really feel for you. I really feel for you. So do I think borderline personality disorder abuse is real too? Yeah, I actually do. I would say when I use the word narcissistic abuse, and I'm glad you brought this up because it's something I actually haven't said out loud, When I use that word, I'm talking about all forms of cluster B abuse. Anything that's due to living with an emotionally immature person, in my opinion, constitutes narcissistic abuse. It isn't just living with a narcissist or living with a sociopath. It's living with anybody who's difficult that makes us feel like we're walking on eggshells. That's how. So thank you for bringing that point up. And for those of you who just may not know who I am, I'm Dr. Carrie Kerr McAvoy. I'm a licensed psychologist with over 20 years of counseling experience. These days, I mostly create content about narcissistic abuse. I also do a lot of writing. I published a book called Love You More, The Harrowing Tales of Lies, Sex Addiction, and Double Cross. I also have blogs if you're interested in kind of my thoughts about various stuff, abuse related, but also life related, grief related. You can check out my website, carriemcavoyphd.com, and there's all my, you know, I think there's like over 100 articles that I've written. I don't currently blog, but I have, and I've done, you know, I'm on medium.com, for example. So yeah, I love thinking about these things, as you can guys can tell, even listening to me. I'm one of these people who sort of like likes to explore and theorize and philosophize about stuff. It's really important to me to understand the nuts and bolts. And just so that you know something about me, I am both a childhood survivor of severe neglect. And obviously now that those of you heard my story, I've also experienced very severe SA. And I'm also, then I ended up marrying a narcissistic sociopath for my second husband. And then on top of it, I experienced the loss of my first husband. I have three sons, all adults. We're all, by the way, on the autistic spectrum. I bet that surprises you that I am autistic on top of it. All my sons are also autistic. So that's kind of creates, we're a very unique family. We're very, very different. But we love each other. We have fun hanging around each other. So, all right. So thank you for asking about narcissistic abuse, because I consider anything that's abusive that has to do with immaturity as narcissistic abuse. How young can narcissism be diagnosed? It cannot be diagnosed until you are over the age of 18. This is an adult condition. Prior to that, there really isn't a diagnosis for teenagers and children. Like, for example, with antisocial personality disorder, they often diagnose those individuals as oppositionally defiant disorder or conduct disorder. So there are kind of two diagnoses that seem to preclude antisocial personality disorder. But by the way, I want to tell you guys, just because you have a child who gets an ODD or a conduct disorder doesn't mean they're going to become antisocial personality disorder. It doesn't mean that. It just generally that's sort of the road of what happens, but it isn't a guarantee. So please don't go out and saying, oh, my kid got this, or my neighbor's kid got this, that means they're going to become a sociopath when they grow up. No, it doesn't mean that. It could mean they're just having a hard time, or there's a lot of trauma in their life, or whatever. So I just want you to know, but that kind of is often the sort of the situation. But there isn't a diagnosis for adolescents and teenagers showing narcissistic tendencies. And by the way, the other part that makes this really hard is that all kids go through two phases that look very narcissistic, as the ages of toddlerhood and adolescence. And both of those are stages in which the self goes under a pretty significant development and a lot of changes. And whenever the brain's growing and changing, it becomes very self-preoccupied and very self-obsessed, very egocentric would be the word we would use in the office. So that's normal. So if you have a very self-centered teen, yeah, they're all very self-centered. That's just part of the growing up. But that doesn't necessarily mean they're going to be narcissists. But yeah, the ability to develop empathy is really important. There's two types of empathy. There's cognitive empathy, and then there's affective empathy. So affective means emotional. So that's like resonating with a Hallmark card ad. When you see it, you get all kind of teary and choked up. Or someone tells you a really rough story, like when I shared my story earlier, you ended up having a kind of, you got choked or affected. That's called affective empathy. Cognitive empathy is the ability to put yourself in someone else's position. So it is imagining what it would feel like to walk in that person's shoes. So if you can imagine that's cognitive empathy. Neurodivergent people tend to struggle with both types of empathy. They particularly have a harder time with affective empathy. I have a hard time with affective empathy, believe it or not. I'm very empathic, but I'm not affectively empathic. I'm very good at cognitive empathy. I'm able to put myself in your shoes and imagine your position very, very well, but I'm not so good with resonating emotionally with you. I struggle with that. So I kind of feel when you, actually my clients loved it because they said I seemed very non-judgmental and very present because I wasn't being all choked up. So I guess there's the benefit. So yeah, but it is able to grow. I saw with my sons having autism, I saw some of them struggling with that. And I did work on it and it helped. I worked it from the angle of asking themselves, if someone's having a tough time or being picked on, I said, well, imagine it was you. How would you feel? I would kind of like try to get them to sort of think about that. And that helped them develop it. Or another way you can do it is to take a show that you guys watch together and say, instead of saying, oh, I liked it or didn't, say, I wonder what would happen if this person did this. Or what do you think this person was feeling when this happened? Or you can even turn the sound off. Here's another experiment. We actually do this as part of clinical training. Turn the sound off so you can't listen to what's being said. And then ask what they witness is happening. Who's upset with whom? Who's closer to who? What's the conflict about? Learn to read the body language. It's a powerful experience. You'll learn so much about the ability to understand other people. So that's a way to kind of grow empathy in somebody who's kind of struggling. The question came across is narcissism genetic? That is one of the big theories out there. They're wondering if it does run in families. So it may be, yeah, there may be something to that. They're also wondering that about some forms of antisocial personality disorder. In fact, they've found a gene, but they find that it's poorly correlated, but it is present, called the warrior gene, like warrior, like a soldier. So if you go out and research it, you can find it. And if any of you have ever done 23andMe, you can download your raw scores, your raw information, and run it through another program that will actually tell you more information, including if you have the warrior gene. I believe it's called Prometheus. Prometheus is another kind of genetic group out there that does studies looking at materials. So it's very, very interesting. Yeah. I do think it's genetic too. That's my suspicion. I see it run in. I have families who tell me that they see it show up in families a lot. I think antisocial personality disorder also, because they found brain structural differences on both groups. Now, here's the powerful thing. Childhood can affect brain structure. So what happens in effect, I don't know if you were aware of this, but one of the forms of developmental delays is due to a impoverished environment. So if you have a child who's not being talked to, they're not being exposed to much, they don't get a chance to have field events and go out and try new things and learn how to go to the grocery store and all that kind of stuff, they're going to have a very stunted IQ. As a result of that, it actually affects the brain. So why would emotional trauma not do the same? So that's the hard part of teasing out which is genetic, which is not, because there probably is so intertwined and so complex, it's going to be really hard to have a direct causal understanding of these things, probably. So, but I do suspect it's kind of interplay of both. Do I have any suggestions on how to handle complex post-traumatic stress disorder due to narcissistic abuse? Yeah, actually, so what I've been currently in some continuing education on narcissistic abuse as well as on trauma. And everything I'm hearing is saying that you need to do therapies that are both left and right brain, hemispheric brain activities. So something that does both. Okay, so for example, talk therapy is very left brain. It's because talk is on the left side for the most part, for most of us. Right side is more emotional, more, but you need something that kind of integrates both. And that's kind of hard because most of counseling is very left brain oriented. Now, EMDR is a really good way to do that. But also you might want to interpose writing, art therapy, music therapy. You might even, there are some other kinds of therapies that I'm not so familiar with. And the more that I learn about them, I'll be sure to pass them on. But you want something that does both modalities, both right and left brain modalities. So sometimes it is kind of expanding your therapy in addition to therapy, maybe learning other things that might help as therapy, like doing art, going into some art therapy, those types of experiences that might be really helpful. So those are the ways to kind of help you to be able to heal. It takes time. It's not going to happen fast. It didn't happen fast when it occurred. It was over a long period of time. So it's going to take time for you to heal from this as well. There is a really great app I reference it in my mental health resource list that I have on my website in a link. At the top, you'll say, click here for mental health links and resources. What it's called, I hate the name, and I can never quite remember the name because it's such an odd name. I wish they named it something different. It's like behavioral skill diary, something like that. But it's near the top of the page. So if you go to the page and look for it, it's I don't know if it's on an Android, but I know it's definitely iPhone, and it costs $7. I know that's, but what it does, let me tell you a little bit about it. It gives you, so you come into a situation, and it gives you ways to help yourself soothe, but it also gives you ways to help you kind of sensory restabilize yourself. Like, for example, washing your face or listening to music. It gives you suggestions that pulls you out of whatever's triggering you and helps you kind of recenter again, both sensory-wise as well as soothing-wise. So it's really helpful. It came out of dialectic behavioral therapy. There you go. DBT. Came out of DBT. It's called, I'm going to try to say the title again, Behavioral Skills Diary, I believe is the title of it. And if you go to my resource list, you'll see a link. I get no affiliate. I have no connection with this company. It's just one of the best that I've heard of. I recommend it a lot. So that's one resource that you can try. Somebody asked, how do you recognize narcissistic abusive behavior or narcissistic behavior? Or how do you address narcissistic behavior that's unrecognized by a family? That's a tough one. The best way to address it is, I guess this really comes back to your motivation. If you're hoping to somehow make them more aware so then they become more accountable, you're going to fail, unfortunately. They're going to disagree with you and they'll probably just better at attacking you for it. I think a better angle to hit this with is for you to change your boundaries. So for you to have a plan at what you're going to do when this happens so that you know what you're going to do the next time. Like, say that something happens around a television show, or maybe it's what happens at the dinner table, or whatever, however it shows up in your home situation. I think if you came at it from the standpoint of, guys, next time this happens, I'm leaving the room. Or next time this discussion goes this way, I'm walking away. Yes, that's it, Melissa. That's a DBT diary. Yes, thank you. Maybe they have changed the name. I think So that's what I would do, Wanda, is I would think through the behaviors you're having problems with. What are the boundaries you wish were happening? And how can you implement them for yourself? But trying to address this outside to say to this person, hey, you're a narcissist, or this is very narcissistic behavior, all they're going to do is debate you over it and then have you tell you why you're wrong. And you know what I'm saying? It's just going to become a fight over what's real. It's not going to profit you in any way. So I wouldn't go there. In fact, I just was listening to Dr. Lindsay Gibson talk about her emotional bill of rights. I don't know if you guys have heard of this. What she said, though, you'd never give the emotionally immature person the bill of rights. First of all, you'd trigger them, and then they would fight you over it. So it doesn't go anywhere. Same with this. If you say, wow, that's gaslighting, they're like, no, it's not. Yeah, it is. So, but you can decide what you're going to do the next time when someone starts to gaslight you. You can kind of figure out your own boundaries. Do you guys know that I have a free newsletter for anyone who's interested? It's 50 tips. It's kind of dripped out over 50 weeks of tips, and it includes boundaries. What are they? How to hold them? How to define them? It's called Surviving Narcissism. And so if you're interested in that, you can sign up through the link in my bio. It's just my gift to you. And also, I've started an online private community for anyone who's interested. That is a paid community, and that's available to anyone who's interested in the surviving narcissism. That's part of it. You can sign up for the free tips. It's free. And then if you want to be a part of the community, I give the first month away for free, and then after that, it's $5 a month. So if that's something, I show up there, talk to you guys. You can support each other. It's just a really great way to have safe space to talk about these things. You know, this is kind of hard form because I know that you don't all get your questions answered. I'm not able to address each one of you individually with this many people in the room, but that's another way to kind of have a more intimate experience, and it's in writing, and it's just, yeah. So I just want to let you be aware of that resource. Can you know 100% if someone is a narcissist? Well, you know, here's a little ugly truth that psychology doesn't want to really like to talk about. It's called inter-rater reliability. So whenever we do a diagnosis with somebody or take a test, there's a rate of degree that it's a fails. That, for example, say you take a blood test to see if you're diabetic. Did you know there's a certain percentage of false positives and false negatives? It's called confidence level. So we usually pick a level of confidence that we want. And depending on the test, for example, you don't ever want to miss cancer, right? That would be terrible. So it's more likely to have a false positive than a false negative, because you don't ever want to have someone have it and not say they have it. So you're more likely to see it even when it's not always there. So every test we give, everything that we do has an error in one of those directions. Either it's going to give false positives or false negatives. Well, with narcissism and all mental health disorders, we are the test. The clinicians are the test. It's our training. In the DSM-5, we use that. But think about it. How do you define entitlement? I probably have a different definition than a clinician who is raised in another country or raised in another area of the United States or had a different theoretical background. I might define it this way. That person might define it that way. So when we come at these, we have to use our best judgment for what defines these criteria. And as a result, that's why you see people come in and say, well, I was diagnosed with this, and then I was diagnosed with this, and then I was diagnosed with this. Could they be all those things? Maybe, but chances are they may have just seen different clinicians who saw a different presentation at that period of time, and at that time it looked like this, and then another time it looked like that. Or maybe this person's theoretical understanding made it look like that. Unfortunately, the rate of reliability between therapists isn't very high. So, back to your question, can anyone 100% know? No, we can't. Now, we all know we're on the spectrum, but how far? But here's what you can know. You can know this person is very difficult to live with. You can be assured they're gaslighting you and that they're invalidating you, that they're ignoring you, walking out on you, showing contempt for you. That's knowable. That's true. You don't need a clinician to just tell you, yes, that's abuse. No, you know it's abuse because it's clear that it is. So that's where I would fall, is I wouldn't worry about the label. I would be more assessing can you be safely you? That's a hallmark of a healthy relationship. Relationships should make you feel free to show up and be completely yourself. If you're not feeling the freedom to do that, then you're at some level of abusive relationship, from mild to major. Yeah, exactly. So that's how you know if someone's healthy or abusive, is what's happening in the relationship and how freely you can really be yourself. And if you can't, then it's not a very healthy relationship. You know, I had an epiphany. My epiphany was as I finished wrapping up the book and I was looking at all the relationships I've had throughout my entire life, I had the epiphany that all of them had been some form of abuse. All of them. I've had to pretty much wipe out my social support system and start over. And that's what happens, is we get acclimated. We're like a frog in boiling water. It doesn't start out boiling, but we get used to a hot temperature and we start picking other situations that are hot temperatures. We don't really realize that we've picked similar people and similar dynamics. Yeah, so part of waking up with this, which is another reason why I think a private community is so important, is that for us to have a safe space to be ourselves, learn how to be different so that we can be different in other relationships and we can expect healthiness because of that, because we get used to it. I really resist the title that we are sick, that's why we pick sick people, but I do think living with sick people makes us sick. I do really believe that. Is a narcissist and codependent a lot the same? So I'm going to kind of change your question. Is narcissistic abuse and codependency a lot the same? I do think they end up making people look quite similar, but I think the root cause is very different. So narcissistic abuse is when we end up in an abusive relationship. I suspect that when we are in this toxic relationships, it starts to make us become people pleasing and very sensitive to what's happening in the, we do a lot of work to try to keep that person happy. That looks a lot like what happens with family members and partners who are living with somebody with an addiction. They're doing the same thing. They're trying to manage this person's illness by like how much alcohol or access is in the house and what do we help them keep their job. And we do all this kind of maneuvering to try to keep us safe as a way to, by keeping them safe. Yes, that starts to happen a lot with those of us who are living in an abusive situation. We try to keep ourselves safe by doing a lot of work by trying to keep the person who's dangerous not so dangerous. So they do a lot, look a lot the same. But what I don't like is having those who are abuse victims be called codependent. We're not codependent. We're trauma victims. We're not in an addictive relationship. We're in an abusive relationship. But yes, they look a lot alike. But so does that, I hope that makes sense. It's the reason is because it means different things and it came about for different reasons. And that's why I don't like the mixing of them. The name of my book, I know some of you asked, the name of my book is called Love You More, Love You More. So if you put that in my last name, you'll find it on Amazon and Apple and everywhere like that. But it's also on the link in my bio. It's a good way to find it. This is a powerful question. I'm so glad you asked it, Dee. I have no kids and I'm not married, maybe. I'm assuming you mean that. Maybe, I'm not for sure. No kids, I'm married. I'm not for sure what you mean about the married, if you're married or not married. But regardless, it doesn't really matter. Why can't I leave? You can't leave because of cognitive dissonance. That's why you can't leave. In fact, I'm so excited, guys. I'm so excited. This author is going to come in for a live webinar. I'm confirming it right now. We're setting the dates with Kristen Milstead. She wrote the book, Why Can't I Just Leave? In this book, she gets in the same type of relationship that I did and that a lot of us have done, and she discusses what cognitive dissonance is. In the book, it's called Why Can't I Just Leave? And she outlines there's three stages. This is going to be, I think, August 18th. I haven't gotten the social media posts up yet, but we're settling on a date right now. I think it's going to be 6:30 p.m. to 8 o'clock. The tickets are $25. If you want free access to the replays, it's $30 for everybody. I'm so excited because, guys, I don't know if you've read this book, but this book is amazing. It really is amazing. It's called Why Can't I Just Leave? She talks about there's three stages of cognitive dissonance, and they're so paralyzing. In fact, I got to hear Sandra Brown as well as Dr. Romani said the same thing. Cognitive dissonance is the agonizing feeling of I can't make a decision. I don't know what's wrong with me, but I can't make a decision. That's cognitive dissonance. It is the number one complaint of abuse victims, number one complaint. It is what's currently is the hottest topic of research at the moment. It's called, this book again is called Why Can't I Just Leave? And the author is Kristen Milstead. Kristen Milstead. She says there's three stages. When you first get into a relationship and you discover it isn't what you think, that something's really wrong, you ask, who did I marry? Or who am I in a relationship with? Who did I get into this relationship with? Are they good or are they bad? I don't know if I don't know if I know this person. That's the first stage of cognitive dissonance, trying to figure out, do I know this person? The stage is, okay, I'm in the relationship and I can't seem to get out. Should I leave or should I stay? I don't know. How do I know? I don't know. I'm confused. And you get really stuck there. And then as you stay longer for longer periods of time, the last stage is, what's wrong with me that I don't leave? Am I sick? What's happening to me? Something's really wrong with me. I feel so stupid and I can't talk about this. That's the last stage. It happens to all of us. It is, oh my goodness. I thought the stress of all of that would kill me. I was shocked how horribly intense and conflicted. And then the hard part is I couldn't tell anybody because they would hear all of this and say, well, it's obvious you need to leave. And I'm like, but it's not that simple because all of the ramifications and all the danger and, you know, this person's scary and toxic and, oh, anyway. So Kristen found herself she's a psychologist. She found herself in a similar situation, but the book breaks. See, my book tells the story of what happens. Her book tells you all the research. She kind of synthesizes all the research around this and explains the paralysis you're in. So I so can't wait to have her as an interview. So it will be, I believe, August 18th, but you'll start to see me post it, talking about it. When we get closer, I'll start to really let you know when it's going to be. And, you know, so it's going to be an amazing thing. But that's why you're stuck, is because of cognitive dissonance. I'm right now working on a course. It's a 10 module course. It will be coming out. The beta reviewers are going to be doing it in June or July. Does narcissists always have a target, like an employee or the next supply or something? Yes, they do. The reason is because they have this insatiable hole. There's something that's kind of in their core missing. In fact, that's why I was talking about how narcissists don't handle downtime very well, because of some kind of inadequacy and immaturity. There's this flatness, this emptiness that's very intolerable. So as a result, they're always strategizing and moving for the next thing, the next high, the next rush, the next. I could tell my ex was always like working on something. You know, he was the other thing they do is they're excessively attached to their phone. There's been research on that, finding that they use their phone as a way to sort of soothe themselves, keep their mind busy, because they cannot stand anything that's literally, you know, relaxing. They always have to be kind of like, they're like an adrenaline junkie, which is really sad, which means they get into a lot of risky behavior as a result of that. How do you co-parent with a narcissist? There is a seminar coming up in June run by Stronger Than Before. She is bringing in, I think, even Judge Anthony and several other people who are like kind of specialists in co-parenting with narcissists. If you're interested in that, again, the link to that is in my bio. You can get tickets to that through my link. It should be a great evening and kind of talk about all the ins and outs, the legal issues, the custody issues, the emotional impact. It's really tough. Bottom line, it's going to be tough. No more than they were agreeable with you around in the marriage or in the relationship, or agreeable with you around getting divorced, they're not going to be agreeable around the custody with the kids. Have you guys heard of the book Biff? Brief. I'm trying to find it. Here it is. Brief, informative, factual, and friendly. Nope. Yeah, friendly, firm. That's what it is. Brief, informative, friendly, and firm. It's written by Bill Eddy, I believe. Yep, Bill Eddy wrote this book, Biff. So it's a really good resource if you want to know how to communicate online through texts, how to keep things kind of as civil as possible. I mean, I know that's tough, but the bottom line is they're going to leverage whatever they can against you. So I really recommend trying to use the gray rock technique, which is minimal words, very dull, very flat, and be repetitive. So say that you've got a situation coming up and you know it's going to be contentious. Figure out what it is your statement's going to be on that, and then stick to it. Repeat it over and over. Like, be literally a broken record. No matter how they fight with you, no matter how they try to attack you, just say, I'll be this. Let's pretend it's around what time is pickup. I don't want pickup to be 3. Pickup's going to be at 3 o'clock on Sunday. Well, why does it have to be that? Does everything have to be your way? Pickup will be at 3 o'clock on Sunday. That's the way things with always with you. You're always so stubborn. Pickup will be at 3 o'clock on Sunday. They don't know what to do with repetitiveness. So when you do that and you're not engageable, you throw them off, for one. It helps you maintain control of the conversation, but it also really keeps it. They can't fight. If you're giving them nothing to hook onto, then they can't stir you up. I'm not saying you're not upset, but if you don't react upset, then they can't hook you to get into how things usually go between them. So that's what I would really strongly urge you to do, is be repetitive, be brief, be flat, and stick to the point. Don't divert, stick to the point. Okay, do narcissists commonly deal with mental illness? Yeah, they often do. They often have it's not unusual for them to have things like comorbidity, maybe with an addiction, or often they struggle with depression and anxiety. There's been some overlap showing with ADHD on top of it. So that's pretty common, but that's common for all of us, by the way. I guess maybe I'm kind of asking myself right now, does something about their personality type make them more susceptible to that? And I'm not for sure I could say that with confidence, but I know that that's not uncommon to have comorbid conditions. That's true for a lot of us. So, but I'm not for sure there's a whole host of disorders that kind of are what's called the narcissist neighborhood, and I listed several of them that you often see kind of occur due to partly because of the behavior and the decisions they're making, but partly also because of the immature personality disorder that kind of causes them to struggle with a lot of like, what does life matter, kind of existential issues that makes them more vulnerable to things like depression. Is it true that narcissists have many faces? Well, I would say they're very good at camouflaging. And part of the problem is because their self is not well defined, then they end up taking the characteristics on of whoever they're around. So they're very fluid that way. Now, they do have a core, but it's kind of more fluid than most of us. So that's why they appear like they're so adaptable because of that. Hey, this is so wonderful hanging out with you guys today. Thank you for joining me on this episode of Breaking Free from Narcissistic Abuse, and I will see you on the next episode.